What is happiness? It's a question so simple a three-year-old would ask it, and a question so complex it has kept scientists busy for centuries and philosophers busy for millennia. One answer is offered by the hedonists. They tell us that the good life is simply a question of feeling good and feeling bad. We can plot this on a simple line from pain to pleasure. The closer you are to the pleasurable end of the scale, the better your life is. But other philosophers aren't satisfied by this. The trouble with this pain/pleasure map of the good life is that it lacks any relationship to consequences, which can't be measured by a moment in time. If the good life was simply about pleasure, then why not take out a bank loan and have a lot of fun? Take heroin, go skydiving, and party like there's no tomorrow? The answer is simple, because there are longer term consequences to our actions. Today's partying is tomorrow's hangover. We can map these consequences by adding another line running north-south from gain to loss. We can think of gain as pleasure extended over time, or as pleasures trend through time. If our actions or experiences now trend towards a lower level of future pleasure, then we can call it loss. If our actions or experiences trend towards a higher level of future pleasure, then we can call it gain. With this two-dimensional map, we factor in the consequences of our action for our future as part of our life satisfaction. We integrate the element of time, which Heidegger finds so essential to the human condition. The good life, then, is the convergence of pleasure in the moment and the trajectory of our lives. At first blush, there's something very satisfying about this new map. It takes stock of our short-term momentary experience and the longer-term trajectory of our lives. But this map also runs into a wall very quickly when we consider the fate of lotto winners and paraplegics. In both of these cases, we see a short-term spike in opposite directions, but when asked to predict how happy they will be in a couple of years, the happiness of paraplegics and lottery winners is more or less the same. And it's not just a property of dramatic examples. There are countless stories of people achieving their long-term goals. They bought the house or they got the promotion. And instead of feeling a burst of fulfillment, they find the rug ripped from under them. These events are associated with the trope of the midlife crisis, but they can happen at any point in life. The simple equation of gain, pleasure equals good life simply doesn't fit reality. This two-dimensional map is missing something, and so we need a third axis. This third line of the Z-axis runs from depression on one end to what is called eudaimonia on the other. The term eudaimonia is an ancient Greek word used by ancient philosophers like Socrates, Aristotle, and the Stoics. It is sometimes translated as happiness, other times as flourishing, satisfaction, or fulfillment. But none of these quite captures the full meaning of the term. The best way to understand what eudaimonia is by looking at its much more common and familiar opposite, depression. In his book, Become Who You Are, from which this video's triple axis theory of the good life is being drawn, the author Ryan Bush outlines the four core traits to the experience of depression: low mood, low vitality, low self-esteem, strong sense of self. By inverting these lows to highs, we can form a picture of what eudaimonia is. High mood, high vitality, high self-esteem, strong sense of self. Note that both depression and eudaimonia shared the strong sense of self. We'll return to this point a little later. The natural next question is, how do we reach eudaimonia? It's fairly obvious that we reach pleasure by increasing our positive emotions, and that we increase gain by improving our circumstances. But how exactly do we move towards eudaimonia and away from depression? With the pop culture portrayal of depression as sadness and lethargy, we might think that pleasure might be the solution. But while this may temporarily impact the first and second components of depression, i.e. low mood and low vitality, the effect will be short-lived. That is because low mood and low vitality are symptoms. The deeper cause is the third component, low self-esteem. We can shoot the arrows of pleasure high in the sky, but the gravity of depression's low self-esteem will drag our mood and vitality back to the level of our self-esteem. This z-axis of depression slash eudaimonia is the hidden force of gravity that pulls lotto winners and paraplegics back into alignment with each other. And so, if we wish to become happier, then it is towards this deeper root that we must direct our attention. On this front, we have two options. We can try to change component 3, our low self-esteem, or we can go after component 4, depression's strong sense of self. In the latter case, we can reduce our experience of depression by weakening our sense of self. This is the path of spirituality. The ego, as the spiritual writers tell us, is the source of all human misery. Hence, by destroying, or to put it more spiritually, by transcending the ego, we can reach a state of deep content away from the nagging voice of the monkey mind ego. But there is a white lie in the spiritual account. In Become Who You Are, Bush presents a suitable analogy for this. Imagine you are at home one cold winter night and you have a HVAC unit which is capable of being both a radiator and an air conditioner. This one cold night, the unit malfunctions, and instead of giving out lovely warm air, it starts blowing out freezing cold air. You don't know anything about how to repair one of these things, and meanwhile, your room is growing increasingly unlivable by the minute. You could take a chance on trying to figure out how to repair the thing. If you're successful, you will have a very nice situation. Or you could take a golf club to the unit and in so doing destroy any chance of getting some warm air coming out, but by the same token, the room doesn't get any colder. Do you try and fix the machine? Or do you destroy it and accept reality as it is? The spiritual path in this admittedly rather loaded analogy is the way of the golf club. You destroy the unit and abandon your strong sense of self in order to form a relationship with reality as it is. So much for the attack on component 4. If we are not looking to go after our strong sense of self, then it seems the best path forward is via component 3, improving our self-esteem. Before we look at how to do this, let's first examine Bush's account of the neuroscience of self-esteem. The default mode network is a network of centers across the brain, including the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate cortex, and the angular gyrus. The default mode network is best known for being active when we are not focused on the outside world. For example, when we are daydreaming or when our minds are wandering, hence the default in default mode network. When we are engaged in a task, the default mode network is usually down-regulated. But rather tellingly, if the task we are engaged in is a self-oriented task, like reflecting on something from our past or thinking about our future, then the network lights up. Some areas of the default mode network control the release of serotonin, which is connected in with our sense of relative status and value of ourselves and others. Another key subsystem is responsible for our ability to take the perspective of others and get inside what they are thinking and feeling. What emerges is a brain network that is fundamental to our self-esteem, something which a 2016 paper by the Chinese team in Chongqing made explicit when they concluded that trait self-esteem is linked to core regions in the default mode network. Another group of researchers, Davy et al. In 2016, went a step further and suggested that the default mode network is the neurological basis for the conscious awareness of the self. All of this fits nicely with those studies which have found meditation decreases activity in the default mode network, and that psychedelics interrupt activity in this network as well. We can see then that our destruction of the HVAC unit in the analogy earlier is neuroscientifically speaking the de-emphasis on the central importance of the default mode network. Meditation takes us out of this monkey mind, and psychedelics can bring about an ego death through the disruption of this network. All of this fits well with the idea that the default mode network is the center of our self-esteem in the brain, and that the path of spirituality works by weakening the sense of self rather than improving it, i.e. taking a bat to the HVAC machine. So how do we fix the HVAC machine? How do we raise our self-esteem so that we are warmed by the tropical air of eudaimonia rather than frozen by the cold air of depression? The answer will sound strange to the 21st century ear, but would sound commonplace to an ancient Greek or Roman ear. The answer is virtue. the beating heart of Stoicism, one that is more or less absent from the 21st century neo-Stoic revival, is the Stoic axiom that virtue is sufficient for happiness / eudaimonia. When Socrates chose death over an escape into exile via bribery, he was choosing virtue. When Cato the Younger chose civil war in ancient Rome over compromise with Caesar's tyranny, he was choosing virtue. When Diogenes was hugging icy statues or whacking off in the marketplace, he was choosing a life of virtue. Virtue sounds prudish and self-righteous to the 21st century ear. It is more commonly heard in the phrase virtue signaling as a way of criticizing performative moralizing than it is in the context of the good life. But it was not this way for the Greeks and Romans. The word that Aristotle uses for virtue is arete, which can also be translated as excellence. In this sense, virtue is what is excellent about us, i.e. anything that is admirable about us. It's not simply about external success. This is where the lotto winner falls down. They aren't admired for their experience of luck. The lotto win can provide them with opportunities to be virtuous, for example, by setting up a business or donating to charity. But the win isn't inherently virtuous because luck isn't admirable, though it is undoubtedly desirable. The same goes for ill-gotten gains. We might have admired Elizabeth Holmes or Sam Bankman-Fried because they seemed to be brilliant minds and business people. But when their enterprises were revealed to be rotten to the core, we realized that much of this virtue simply wasn't there. No doubt there was hard work and many other admirable qualities involved, but not the technical genius or business acumen for which they were held so high. These latter virtues vanished in a puff of illusion. Virtue then is admirability. When we feel admirable, our self-esteem rises. Because of the default mode network, we don't need to be recognized for this in order to be happy. We don't need to rely on the external scorecard of social status when we've got an internal meter that's keeping score for us in-house. When we are living an admirable life, our self-esteem, by definition, rises. When it comes to Holmes or Bankman-Fried, we can see that what is admirable is not wealth. It's not outward success. Outward success is at best a mere reflection of admirability, since society is an outgrowth of humanity, and thus what is esteemed by humans correlates with status in society. But we also admire those who are not necessarily successful or high status, but those who are good parents, who display integrity, who are honest or hardworking or courageous or creative. These virtues aren't the kind that market capitalism necessarily rewards, but being universal values, our internal scorecards do. The virtuous life, then, exists on a separate axis to gain / loss and pain / pleasure. In being honest or acting with integrity, we are being admirable, even if we end up losing a job or a relationship. The landscape of the 3D overview sees our sense of well-being not entirely decoupled from gain and pleasure, but marching to its own drummer. More gain can enable more possibility to be virtuous, but it is not inherently a step towards the ultimate well-being in life that is eudaimonia. Given this relative decoupling of gain and eudaimonia, what we have to orient ourselves by is not the outward signs of gain, but the life of virtue. It's not about how much other people see our virtue. Who we are signaling to is not those outside, but the judge in our head. That default mode network which in those idle moments wafts us with warm feelings of eudaimonia or cold feelings of depression based on its evaluation of how admirable we are. So what is the good life? Ryan Bush boils it down to this simple equation. E equals NV to the S. In plain English, that is eudaimonia E equals net virtue self-signaled. That is to say that the good life can be measured by the total amount of virtue that we signal to ourselves. Or, as the ancients put it, virtue is sufficient for eudaimonia. That's everything for this episode of The Living Philosophy. If you'd like to learn more, I did a long-form podcast with Ryan Bush for our Patreon members, which I will link in the cards and description. And I'd highly recommend Bush's book, Become Who You Are, which I'll also link down in the description. As ever, I'd like to thank David Pelibosian, Ibisofeisa, and all the other patrons for their support of the channel. If you'd like to get access to weekly bonus episodes, monthly Q&As, and get your name in the credits like these fine people, then you can head over to Patreon. As ever, if you have any thoughts, insights, or feedback, I'd love to hear from you down in the comments. Otherwise, I shall see you next time. Thank you for watching.